Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guests, Julie Pace, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, a position she just moved into, and Peter Baker, the Chief White House Correspondent for the New York Times, and the author of a new book out called The Call of History, which is about the Obama presidency, all sorts of photos by New York Times photographers. Why them? Well, President Trump wants to have a war with the media. It's pretty clear. He sees the political advantage of it, and in judging from whatever cost-benefit analysis they're making in the White House, it seems like they're willing to take the costs for the benefits that they get out of this. They go after reporters, they go after news outlets, and of course, in just the last week, we've had what seems like elevated to a new place of the attacks on Mika Brzezinski for having a facelift, which a lot of people reacted to and said was a new low. Then over July 4th weekend on Sunday, the president tweeting that video of him when he was at the WWF, but with the CNN logo superimposed on the person he was beating up, that did not get as condemned as the Mika Brzezinski tweet. But of course, it's all part of the same continuum. So what does everybody do about that? What do you do if you are a White House reporter and it's your job to cover the president and the people who work for him every day? Julie and Peter are people that I covered the beat with when I was there every day covering Obama, and they are still there covering Donald Trump. I think you'll find the conversation really interesting, as well as what they can tell you about Donald Trump and the people who work for him that may not be immediately obvious, and what they can tell you about how some of the assumptions about reporting about the White House have changed and been challenged in ways that they will maybe surprise you, say are actually kind of positive. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. We have some excellent episodes coming up, including with Senator Mike Lee up next. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover and on Facebook, and email me with your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, our conversation with Julie Pace and Peter Baker. All right. So we just talked.
Okay.
What's the moment that it hits you in covering the White House that this is different, that this is not Barack Obama's White House?
It hits me every day. I mean, there.
Well, what's the first moment do you remember that when you're like, wow.
I do. Yeah, I do. It was the Saturday after inauguration.
The day after.
And we had six people packed in our booth at the White House, the AP booth. And it's a Saturday, which is unusual that we're that packed in there. And he goes to the CIA, Trump does, and he gives this very Trumpian speech at the CIA. And that was like a half moment where it hit me. But then the real moment is when Sean Spicer came out to the briefing room and barked at us for, you know, however many minutes, left without taking questions. And a shell-shocked colleague of mine kind of walked back in and just gave me this look. And I smiled and I was like, all right, this is it. This is our new world. This is what we're going to do. And kind of gave the team a pep talk and, you know, said, yeah, this is what we're going to be covering for the next 4 years. And, you know, get ready. But that was the moment.
It's kind of the weird thing to me of that the White House, it's the same podium, it's the same room, it's the same planes, but then it's just like a completely different cast of characters who are in there.
Right? Yeah.
And you left before, Peter, before Obama was done and
I
came
left.
Back to it.
You were, I left. I was gone. I was out.
But they pulled you back in. What's that? How did that happen? You get the call on November 9th that just says, hey, so much for being in Israel. We need you back.
Yeah, I had relocated to Jerusalem. It was going to be the Jerusalem bureau chief for 3 years. I was excited. I moved there in August of 16. And yeah, we're watching, you know, we're up at 3 a.m. like everybody else watching the election results. And it looks like it's going to be Trump. And I get a text actually from your ex-boss, my current wife, who's back in Washington running
political coverage. Your then-wife also.
Then-wife, current wife, future wife. And she texts me saying, you know they're going to want you back to come back to D.C. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she predicted it before I even had thought about it. And sure enough, the editors called. It took a few weeks kind of to go back and forth. What do we really want? But they called and asked if I would come back, yeah.
Was it a process of – Julie, you were on the campaign following around. So come back and talk about that in a second. But when you were coming back, then is there a process of getting up to speed? How does that work? Are you just calling people and trying to get them to return your emails?
I'm still working on that, yeah. It's always a bad thing, I think, in a way, to cover White House without having covered the campaign, right? And Julie knows that better. Because people get to know you on a campaign. They see that you're there every day. They see that you understand their where they came from, the creation myths that every White House kind of produces on about itself. And coming in cold, I don't know these people from Adam. And there had been some thought that I might know some people because I've covered a Republican administration in the past. It's a very different group.
Not this Republican.
There are very few.
Right.
Yeah, not a lot of overlap between the Bush White House and this White House. So yeah, I'm still getting up to speed, and I don't know a lot of the people even now.
Is it the when you're there on the campaign trail, there's also you can have access to them. You see them all the time, especially with the Trump campaign, I imagine, when it's not only a small campaign, but there, for a long time it was like nobody thought, including them, that they were actually going to be in the White House, right? Which is different from now when they have their West Wing offices and
absolutely.
You can't get to them without an invitation.
You had access not just to the small core group of staff. You had access to Trump himself. I mean, he was accessible. And, you know, he would call you. You could call him. You could, you know, have hour-long interviews in his office. It was a totally different experience than any other campaign that I had covered. But a lot of the experience of covering him on the campaign has been really helpful, you know, in terms of knowing the staff, in terms of having a bit of a relationship with him. But it's him now in this totally different context. So the campaign experience, while it's helpful, I think only goes so far in this context.
Do you still have his cell phone number?
I still have it. I still have a cell phone number for him.
But you haven't tried it since?
The last time I tried it was during the transition.
And did he pick up?
He did.
Was he surprised to hear from you, or he just started talking?
It's hard to know. I mean, I still think that it is this really bizarre relationship that he has with the press that while I'm sure he was surprised, he still talked to me for a few minutes. So he wasn't so surprised or so thrown that he didn't talk.
Right.
His whole career has been talking to reporters, right? I mean, the moment that I remember, it was just crazy. It was during the transition, but it was at the Golden Globes when Meryl Streep went after him. And then your colleague, Patrick Healy, called him on his cell phone at like 12:15, like after midnight. And
Who does that?
Well, Donald Trump. Right?
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Never seen – this is my fourth president. I've never called any of them on the phone. None of them has ever –
So you don't have a cell phone.
I do not
number.
Have a cell phone.
Maybe
but somebody on my
afterwards.
Staff. We do have – we have a cell phone. I don't know if it works anymore.
So let's get this out of the way. Does this White House lie? Does this president lie?
That's quite the question. Let me say this. I have had people lie to me in other White Houses as well. It's not a wholly unique feature to Washington. It's not a phenomenon of the Trump administration. I do think that there are some really obvious examples going back to the moment where, you know, it kind of hit me that this was different where, you know, they just say things that I just don't think are necessary to advancing their agenda to lie or to kind of skirt the truth on. I mean, the inaugural crowd size was only a story because the White House chose to make it a story. So that's what I am constantly surprised by, the types of things that you find yourself in this battle with them over the facts on, where they're just not really that consequential. That, to me, is the difference with this White House.
So it's that big lie versus little lie thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like what is – there are some things where there actually is a difference in how we might view the facts, frankly, than an administration might view them. I mean that is – we sometimes live in different realities. But sometimes they choose to battle over something that just seems so insignificant to me. But in the minds of the White House and in the minds of the president, it actually is worth
– Why do you think that
the
is?
Fight. I don't know. That's a great question. I think with the crowd size, you know, it tied into what I think is a big part of Trump, which is that, you know, he feels like people look at him in this job and don't think that he either deserves to be there or think something happened during the election that, you know, only because of that is he president. And the crowd size, the way the inaugural was covered kind of tied into that. So that piece of it I understand. The motivations behind some of the other things I truly don't understand.
Peter, I heard you say last week that you were talking about the difference between how Trump has approached Obama and previous presidents have approached their predecessors. Is that you don't – every president, especially when there's a change of party, does things differently and tries to undo some of the things. But for Trump, it seems to be the main motivating factor in a lot of the decisions. How does that play out? I mean, is that – it seems like some of that is what was going on with the crowd size because it was a comparison to Obama's crowd
right.
size, right?
Yeah.
Is that – do you feel like that's playing out every day in what the White House is thinking about doing?
It does. I mean, in some ways, Obama still is in their heads, right? You know, everything has to be not what he did. Everything has to be undoing what he did. And if you believe that Obama's presidency was a disaster, as they do then that might be perfectly justified. But he does seem to be spending a lot more time undoing things than simply moving in a different direction, right? So Obama moved in a different direction than Bush, but he didn't spend a lot of time actually deconstructing whole programs or policies that Bush had left behind. He didn't deconstruct the PEPFAR program or Medicare Part D or the Department of Homeland Security. He actually didn't even really change counterterrorism policy nearly as much as he had talked about doing on the campaign trail, because Bush had already kind of moderated to some extent. Trump seems very, very determined to, like, sort of brick by brick, take a sledgehammer to Obama's legacy. Obviously, we see healthcare, Dodd-Frank, Wall Street regulations, the clean energy stuff by EPA, the TPP trade deal, the Paris climate deal. It's not just that he's moving in a different direction. It's that he wants to undo previous things. At some point, he'll be done with that because either he will have succeeded or failed. And he'll have to begin moving proactively forward. What does a trade deal under President Trump look like if we don't like the one that President Obama did? What do our alliances look like if we don't like the ones that President Obama had created?
Do you think that defines the relationship that he and his staff have with the White House, with the White House reporters, rather, in some way that they feel like there were always attacks from conservatives saying that White House reporters under Obama were too cozy and too forgiving of all of Obama's wrongs. Mm. Is some of the anti-Obamaism feeding the way that they relate to the press?
Look, some of it is, and I think some of it is that they just feel battered and beaten, and I get it. It's a hard job, and it's not easy, and they hadn't done it before, so to them it feels new, right? It's hard not to react when they say it from the podium, well, you guys never asked Obama about X. And actually, we all say, well, yeah, we did. Yes, we did. And we can point to this briefing and this briefing. These are exactly the kind of questions we asked Obama's people all the time. But they never experienced it. They weren't there either on the podium side or on our side, so they're not as familiar with the way the briefing room worked prior to their arrival. I would say, frankly, we have not, you know, we have been tough on Trump just like we were tough on Obama, just like we were tough on Bush. And it's a meat grinder. I don't blame people for not liking it. It can be very difficult.
And the difference for them is that they are up to the president himself, following the coverage so carefully. I mean, the press office is there to follow the coverage. That's part of their job. But I didn't experience, at least with Obama, that all the way up to the top into the Oval Office, that the president was in real time following the coverage. He would read the papers. He knew generally what the narrative was. He knew big stories that were going on. But the almost minute by minute involvement of the high ranking officials and the president in the coverage is so striking to me, because it impacts how they do their job every day. And that, to me, like, can they carry that out for 4 years? Because he's going to have to make decisions that are going to be unpopular and are going to be covered really aggressively, and he's going to get negative reactions to them, but they're going to be the right decision long term. And can he kind of get past the short-term fallout to make what would inevitably be the right decision for the country?
With Obama, I could always tell if he'd read an article, because you did get a phone call. And the phone call would be inordinately angry and inordinately hateful and beyond anything, often with the same person you had talked to before the story who had no problem with it. And so you could tell Obama had read it and it was, you know, X was flowing downhill, right? I think you're right. I think Trump reads everything and watches so much that a lot more flows downhill than in previous White Houses. Bush did not watch a lot of television news. And Obama, I think, pretty much did not watch a lot of television news. I think they both read newspapers and wire stories and print magazines and Politico and so forth more.
You don't have to give a Politico plug.
I think that's true. I think they did read that. Politico had a big influence on the last White House. We could talk about that at some point. But
no, I think it's funny, with the Obama folks used to never admit that they read it.
But then the president himself would reference.
It's always funny in our newsroom. He would, in private meetings with members of the the House or Senate say, "Oh, don't like do the Politico thing," and then like the next day quote a Politico article.
Absolutely, right. But I don't think they watch television as much.
Right.
And it does seem to be television that's gotten under this president's skin more than anything, more than in CNN in particular. Obviously, some of the MSNBC shows.
One of the MSNBC shows.
Yeah. Right. Well, that has trickled down to the staff, which then feels necessary to be, you know, combative in response.
You did not answer the question about whether they lie.
Oh, I wasn't asked the question whether they lie.
I asked it to both of you.
I picked that one up for you. Don't worry.
Awesome job with that. Look, every White House lies. Every president has lied. Sometimes there are lies of omission. Sometimes there are lies of commission. Sometimes they're, you know, exaggeration, right? Everybody has their own narrative. Sometimes it's, you know, you can argue about it. This one has this is more intense, and there's more of it than we've ever seen, I think, in our last generation anyway.
Why are we so uncomfortable using the word lie?
Well,
I mean, that wasn't like the royal we.
Yeah.
Everybody.
I'll give you my editor, Dean Becquet, has authorized the use of the word lie in I think three or four headlines that we've done over the last number of months. And he defends it by saying there are times when it just reaches beyond a disagreement over facts or a false statement that a person might not intend to be false. And he decides that he feels like it's appropriate. I'm very cautious myself about the L word. I think that it implies intent. It implies that we can read somebody's mind and know that they are intentionally deceiving. There are instances where I think that may be justified when somebody has been corrected on something enough times and there is absolutely zero countervailing evidence and yet continues to say something like that, where I think that's probably more justified. But in general, I would prefer to use things like false statements if they're false, inaccurate, untrue, whatever, and not try to read somebody's mind.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by the governor of Maine, Paul LePage, said today in an interview that it was railing against the press, and he said that sometimes he makes up stories on purpose to – this is an AP mm-hmm. story, actually – to get them out there and make reporters wrong. That's lying, right?
That's lying. I mean, I'm with Peter on this. The first time –
because that's an intentionality.
That's intention. The first time I think we used it was during the campaign – when Trump finally gave the very brief statement that Obama actually was born in the United
yes.
States. And that was one of those – that was one of those situations where it had been, you know, fact-checked so many times that if you were continuing to say it, there was really no other way to describe it. But I am always – in general, even beyond the use of the word lie, I am always reluctant as a reporter who wants to be a pure reporter and not an opinion columnist. I'm always reluctant to try to assign motivation on anything without reporting to back it up. And I think that, you know, we are in a situation where we're just in a fight every day for the public's trust. And the more we try to overreach and assign motivation when we don't really know it, I think the faster that trust will start to erode.
It seems like one of the tricks that happens, though, is that we have to when we hear something, we want to confirm it with someone else. So what do you do when you hear a detail or some fact and you bring it to someone else and that person says to you it's not true, but you have a feeling like maybe they're not being fully honest with you?
I actually have had the opposite situation happen where you'll have something and you go ask someone and they're like, oh yeah, that happened. And you realize I'm not actually sure they know that happened, but they want that narrative to be out there,
yeah.
Which I think is –
so how do you navigate around that?
It's really tricky. I mean the biggest thing you can do is talk to as many people as possible about that nugget. If you need to – instead of having two people confirm it, you need to get three or four. And then I think you need to be pretty transparent in your story where you say four people confirmed that this happened. You know, two people did not. There was a dispute over whether this happened. And you just have to show your work a little bit more.
And by the way, in fairness, in any presidency, any White House, so much happens that these guys – do genuinely forget things or misremember things or remember things differently than each other.
Mm-hmm.
We all have our own memory of this conversation later on. And Isaac will say, well, I remember it this way. And
that's why we're recording it, Peter.
Exactly, because I don't trust me. And I remember I did a book on the Clinton impeachment, and there was this scene where John Podesta was then the White House chief of staff, later becomes Hillary Clinton's, of course, campaign chairman. And he's so mad that somebody in the White House had leaked a draft of a apology that Clinton would give over the Monica Lewinsky affair. And he gets up there and he says, somebody in this room, and he used a very colorful epithet that I won't say.
We're on a podcast. You can if you want.
Are we allowed to say? Yeah. Somebody in this room rat-fucked the president last night.
It was a favorite word of
his. He's a favorite word of his. I love the scene.
Dennis McDonough liked it, too.
It was very real, right? It was very real. So I checked around, and I had several people say, yeah, that's what he said. And then before the book went to press, I went to John and I said, listen, this is what I'm – just here are the things I'm reporting. Tell me if you, you know, confirm or deny. And he denied. He said, no, I never used that word. I never would have said that. I'm like, okay. So I went back and I talked to like 8 of the people who had been in that room all over again. And without prompting, I said, what did he say? I didn't say, did he say this? I said, what did he say? And all of them remembered exactly the phrase, exactly the same. And I think John genuinely didn't remember that he had said it that way. People don't. So I think your point is exactly right. I mean, the more we verify, the more people we talk to, the better off we are, and better to hold back if we're not sure than to publish something we're not
And that ends up explaining what has now become a pretty common feature of stories across publications where it says, like, these reporters talked to 17 different officials or whatever, which was not something that was part of Obama White House coverage or Bush
race.
Or whatever, right?
It's an arms race of sources. We have 32 sources.
But I think it's important that we do that. I mean, like, just to go back to the point I was making before, I mean, this is about maintaining our trust with the public. And the more that we can show our work, the more that we can highlight the fact that this is just not one anonymous source out there, that this is the reflection of our reporting, you know, across the board, multiple people inside and outside the White House. I hope that that the public reads those kind of stories and says, oh, well, this is legit. Like, they really talk to a lot of people for this. I hope that that's how a reader would look at that.
Do you find that in dealing with the White House aides that they have a different relationship with you when they're not on the record, when they're not, the cameras aren't on? Is it the same war? Are you at war with them when you're talking to them?
You know, I like a lot of the people who work for the Trump administration. I think that I've known a lot of them for a long time. Some are newer to me. I like them. And, you know, you tell people that sometimes and they then see them go on TV and just take these big swipes at the media. And to some extent, I expect that because that is their job. That is something that they have made central to this presidency. It's not a sideshow for them. The attacks on the media, trying to undermine our credibility, they see as very much part of the Trump agenda. But I do think that, you know, there – again, this applies to, I think, any White House, but there is this sort of public-facing – war on the media, and then, you know, private personal relationships that we all have with our sources. That
is it a show though?
I don't. I don't think it's a show in the sense that I do think that they see this as part of the agenda. I mean, this is something that they believe is central to Trump's success, is to try to undermine negative coverage about him. So I think that they believe in that mission. I really do. I think that some of it is theatrics in the sense that they're trying to play it up in certain ways, that they are trying to make certain things a bigger deal than they actually are. But I actually think that the effort in and of itself they see as almost a policy mission.
Have you ever had a situation where somebody who works in the White House has in public just said something and then in private had a very different kind of conversation with you about – And I'm talking not just – not factually, but in the tone and the aggressiveness.
Yeah, of course. In fact, I mean, some of the people – it is sometimes frustrating that in private White House officials, not just this White House, as Julie said, can be pretty bracingly honest and candid about their own problems, challenges, setbacks, mistakes, or whatever. But then when they come on camera, they act like anybody who's questioning them is disloyal to them, disloyal to the country, somehow, you know, nattering nabobs, whatever. And, you know, my colleague, my friend Rajiv Chandrasekharan once quoted an official in Iraq saying, on the record, you know, freedom is on the rise. Off the record, Rome is burning. You know, and it's this contrast between, you know, like this sort of fake, you know, positiveness versus the, you know, dire reality. It's a shame that we can't find some middle ground where candor can take a little bit more of a front and center.
Do you feel like it's a show, the attack on the media?
Well, I say this. Nobody's ever lost votes attacking the media, as far as I can tell.
Mama used to love doing it. Right?
Yeah,
he would,
sure.
He would do it in sort of not as an aggressive way. There were no wrestling videos.
It was more aggressive.
But it was the media critic and would talk about what we all just didn't understand.
Yes. Right.
It was derisive. It was sometimes condescending, but it was not a full frontal, like, you are the enemy of the people. But look, this is not the first president who thought all this. He's the first president, perhaps, who has said it so loudly and publicly. If you go back, this is basically the Nixon tapes as if they were played live on television every day or on Twitter. Clinton certainly felt very angry toward the press day in and day out for much of his presidency. Bush certainly had his moments, although I think he was a little more – he let stuff go sometimes. They just didn't express it. They just didn't see it as being presidential, or they didn't see it as being political or useful or whatever, but they didn't do it the way President Trump does. President Trump, the one good thing or bad thing about him, you know what he thinks. And I think in some ways there is a refreshing quality to that, because there's no guessing about what – there's no unexpressed thought. Now, you may not agree with the thoughts. We may think them crude in some ways or unpresidential.
Do you think
but
that
we
that's
know
true that the tweets are – and they're never structured on purpose?
I'm not saying never.
Okay.
Clearly, sometimes they are.
Yeah.
And clearly, by the way, he does have discipline over them. For all this, he can't control himself. He doesn't do on foreign policy what he does domestically, right? You mentioned Meryl Streep. He goes after Meryl Streep. He goes after, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger. He goes after cultural figures. He goes after individual reporters or whatever. Politicians crying, Chuck Schumer, mm-hmm. right? He's not given
nicknames.
Well,
with Kim Jong-un, right, doesn't this guy have anything better to do? That was his reaction to the missile test, right?
Yeah, right. But most of what he's done with the foreign people has been much of a different quality, right?
Right.
He's not quite as personal,
somebody has told him, this is foreign policy, it's not the same thing.
The name calling isn't there, yeah.
Right.
I think is key.
Like Bashar al-Assad, a nickname.
You were searching for
I was
one,
wondering what nickname you were going to come up with
know.
There
I'll
for
let him
Assad.
Do that. I'll let him do that. I'm not a nickname guy. But he doesn't do that, right? He doesn't troll people. He didn't. He says things about Germany, right? But he doesn't make it personal about Merkel, right, on Twitter or whatever. I mean, there is a restraint.
The one that I remember, actually, as you're saying it, is on Canada Day a couple days ago, he said something about, my new friend, Justin Trudeau,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is weird. We don't think of him speaking personally about somebody and it being positive.
In a positive way.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. But he clearly, therefore, does have ability to control his Twitter habit if he chooses to. And he didn't do any tweets of any incendiary types on the first foreign trip that he did to Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Europe. So, but on the other ones, he just doesn't hold back.
Do you think that we and again, the we here, I guess, would be reporters, people who are employed in professional media, make too much of the attacks, the Mika Brzezinski tweet, the CNN video?
Yeah, I think we do. I think we have to be really cautious in our overreactions. I think that Isaac and I were talking about this earlier. I mean, everything can't be a 10. And when you make everything a 10, then nothing is impactful anymore. And I also think when it comes to the attacks on the media, look, this is something that we struggle with as an industry, and we have to get better at this. When he goes after the media, we can't make it about us.
Yes.
Every time we make it about us, every time one of us in the royal us becomes the face of the fight, I think we fail.
Absolutely.
Because we lose the whole point of what we're doing. And the whole point of what we're doing is to be conduits to the public and to provide the public information that they can't get on their own, to provide them the backstory when the White House is putting the sunny face on something, to provide them the reality of the situation, the Rome is burning situation. Yeah. And if we lose track of that, if we don't make that the center of the fight, the public is going to tune us out on that. I so strongly believe in our role in providing the context of why this is important.
To me, it's the struggle between figuring out, okay, well, this is an attack on free press, it seems, and what do we do about that? And should reporters respond to it and be defensive about it? Versus we have spent 5 or 6 days talking about a ridiculous wrestling video and not as much time talking about the fact that North Korea launched a missile.
Yeah, I think we're big boys and girls and we ought to have thick skins and, we get attacked. So what? Big deal. And I think Julie's exactly right and you're exactly right. The distinction ought to be between policies that inhibit access, right? If the White House were to take policy decisions and kick us out of the West Wing, let's say, or you know, stop briefings altogether, or whatever. These are issues where we need to stand up and express something because we're defending an institution. But I don't think we should get so worked up about the attacks because we're not the opposition. And I know he says we are. We're not. And we ought not to pretend – we're not ought to fall into that trap because once we're the opposition, then we're not what Julie said. We have to be independent, neutral, at least the reporting side, opinion. People can do what they want. Conveyors of information, and we, you know, we're not players in this; we're observers.
Has CNN done it wrong? Then you think?
I think CNN has chosen to be pretty feisty in its response, and it's sort of playing on his turf to some extent. And I don't know that it's helping them, but it's not the choice that I think we would make right now.
Do you feel like it could lead to actual violence against a reporter?
We've talked about that, actually. And I think a number of news organizations have increased their security lately, not because of anything specifically done by any politician or the White House specifically, but because, in fact, the environment overall has grown so toxic. And you never know what can happen. And I think that that would argue for toning it down a little bit on our side as much as anything else. But
I worry because not because of an individual tweet or because of an individual, you know, statement at a rally or at the briefing room. I just worry that the climate has gotten so hot right now.
Like, do you think that there's going to be a reporter who's attacked? They were during the campaign.
The campaign, if you went to a Trump rally, at least verbally, you would really come in for it. I mean, it got pretty intense. You know, I wasn't out there as much as some of my colleagues who were, you know, on the plane, on the Trump press plane every day, but you would go and it would get hot and it would get personal and they knew reporters by name.
Especially the TV reporters.
And I mean, that worries me.
But somehow do you think it'll get to like a physical attack?
I hope it doesn't.
There was when the shooting happened at the congressional baseball game, part of what was said was, okay, well, this is the political climate, the rhetoric has gotten so out of control. Well, yeah, like people are going to start shooting each other.
Yeah.
Are we in danger of that happening?
There's no reason to think that it couldn't happen just like it happened on that baseball field. And that was by a liberal who's upset at Republicans. It could happen the exact opposite way. And it can happen, I think, with reporters as well. And it's a reflection of the climate right now. And, you know, it would be, you know, to the extent that we can find a way to lower the temperature and have our disagreements play out in a more constructive and productive way, obviously, that would probably be better. But we don't control that. What we can do is control our side of things and try to make sure we're as professional as we can be.
Is it an enjoyable experience to cover the White House?
It is. I love covering the White House. I think
the same in the same way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the White House beat gets a bad rap sometimes. I think, you know, story for story, day to day, you could not find a more interesting beat to cover. I mean, the history that passes through your desk covering Obama or Trump is just unmatchable anywhere else.
I mean, no matter what happens.
No matter what happens. And I think, you know, I've covered Obama and Trump, both historic figures in very different ways. And to pass that up, I think, is, you know, would be crazy.
But yeah. But there's a sense that a lot of people have that it's just sort of soul crushing.
Well, can't soul crushing be fun?
It depends what your idea of fun is, Peter.
I agree with you. I think it's a lot of fun. I think there are different reporters, right? Types of reporters, right? Some of them really get a kick out of the White House. I do. This is my fourth season.
You were all the way on the other side of the ocean. You didn't have to say yes, right?
I came back. And then there are some who find it very hampering, you know, constraining, regardless of who's president, that you can't. You know, you spend too much time litigating, not reporting, right? But, you know, can this be on the record? Can this be off in background? Can this be embargoed for this? And there are no doubt days when on the White House beat it feels like it's just more about, you know, nonsensical things than serious things. But as Julie says, history is this is the history beat. And to get to cover it every day is a privilege, and no matter who's president.
But do you think – is that – as true with Donald Trump as president with this crew in.
Yeah. In fact, arguably more important because, in fact, we are testing boundaries.
I'm not asking about important. I'm talking about in terms of your life. And the...
Well, my life. I'm up earlier. And I have a little phone next to me in bed that tweets, that buzzes when tweets go off at 5 in the morning. So there are some lifestyle changes. But
I mean, this has been a really intense period of time. But I have told people on our White House team, I mean, I remember covering the opening months of the Obama administration, which was similarly intense, but for a very different reason. I mean, we were living through an economic crisis at that time. And every day you were waking up to, you know, terrible job reports and the stock market and these just really terrible stories from around the country. That was super intense. This is intense for different reasons, but it's I find it actually really motivating and really invigorating as opposed to soul crushing.
Actually, how do you feel about it?
Well, I think it's a tricky experience, right? Mm-hmm. To be whether they're trying to draw reporters into fights all the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. I didn't cover the beginning of the Obama administration the way that you guys did. I came onto the beat later, but it seems to me like at the beginning of any administration, you're going to have just a nonstop crowd
right.
of news.
Everything's new.
And inevitably, when you have this massive of a change, that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But there are all sorts of things that we did not realize. I think that we were taking for granted, or thinking about how many sources do we say we have? How do we go about checking something that's true that now add to the complications of doing it? Right, and when you have a group of people from the president on down who are looking for stumbles, right, and want to jump on them, that gets really tricky, right?
Well, it is. It means we need to be better and more professional than ever. I mean, it means that we need to get our P's and Q's, or ducks in a row, whatever cliche you want to use, and not make mistakes. And
you're a journalist. You're not supposed to use cliches.
You're right. Thank God they're editors. Because, but we need to make sure we're doing it right. And when we make mistakes, which we do, we need to learn from them, and we need to make sure we correct them, and we need to be transparent about how they happen and make clear to readers and viewers that they are honest mistakes and not mistakes of intent.
I think that it's important that we all remember it's a human enterprise, journalism. There will be mistakes. The best thing that we can do when something goes wrong is just own it. Mm-hmm. And I think that long term, that lends to our credibility, our willingness to do that. I mean, that's what sets this industry apart, is our willingness to be transparent when we make mistakes.
So last question, what do people not get about Donald Trump that, from your experience of covering him from being up close, you think they should sort of put into their heads to shape the portrait a little bit differently?
I think he wants to be a successful president. I really do. I think that he is unsure right now how to do that long term. I think that he's, you know, still focused on winning the day and the week. But I think that he wants to end up his presidency, whether it's 4 or 8 years, and be looked upon as a great president. And that actually is a motivator for him. It's not always, I think, playing out in the ways that he would want it to. But that is, I think, his goal.
Peter?
No, I agree with that. I think that's exactly right. I think nobody wants to be thought of as a bad president. But he especially, more than most, I think, is conscious of being viewed as a success, as a winner. How he defines
it's funny because it was like
question.
Obama was really obsessed with his place in presidential
sure.
history.
Of course.
But you think Trump is in the same way?
Each of them is. It's you know, they've gone through this extraordinary journey to get to this place where out of 330 million people, they are the one leader. Of course, you have to have a certain degree.
And they're one of 44 people who've ever held the job.
Ever had the job, exactly. I like your Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland doesn't get counted twice in my mind.
Twice. But it's, yeah, and so I think he does want to be successful. Now, how he chooses to get there, whether he is open to advice, whether he is open to change, that'll be what we see. Interesting in some ways, he is more flexible than most presidents, right? Maybe mm-hmm. for good, maybe for bad. But he seems less locked into most of the things he's been committed to than many.
In a sort of predictable way, right? This is my feeling about Trump. I've said this elsewhere, is that there's the unpredictability is often very predictable.
Absolutely. I think there are very few things where he is just like core wedded to, and that would be the idea that America is getting shafted,
right,
and that would be on trade or alliances and so forth. But beyond that, I don't think he's locked into this healthcare plan or that healthcare plan or this infrastructure scheme or that. You know, he wants to get stuff done. If he chooses to, if he figures out how to do the job, in a way that works for him, then he has an opportunity to actually make a lot of progress. We'll see whether he takes it.
All right. Peter Baker, Julie Pace, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Peter Baker, Chief White House Correspondent for The New York Times and the author of The Words in the Call of History book, out now, and Julie Pace, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Thanks, as always, to Bridget Mulcahy, our producer, and our intern, Rachel Cusick. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Coming up, an interview with Senator Mike Lee about the Founding Fathers and what they would make of the whole healthcare mess going on now. And down the road, an interview with Maz Jobrani, the comedian, talking about the immigrant experience and how you make comedy out of activism.